We are thrilled to have Panacea Financial as a sponsor, providing banking built for doctors by doctors. Hear what Dr. Michael Juergens, a MedPeds physician and co-founder of Panacea Financial, had to say about one thing that makes Panacea Financial really different.
Every customer, even if you're someone with $5 in one of our checking accounts or you have a personal loan, every single customer gets their own what we call primary care banker. So you have a singular point of contact that knows you and just text or email that same person who actually knows you. As a primary care physician by trade, we based this role really off of what I do, which is trying to be a singular point of contact for my patients and coordinating their care. And it's the same thing we do at Panacea Financial. For instance, my wife called me, can we move some money over to a different account? I can't get into my app. And I'm like, hey, I can't help you with this right now because I have to see patients. But both of us have a primary care banker at Panacea that she's able to email or text, and they're able to help with their account issues right then and there instead of having to call a 1-800 number and wait on hold. And then all of a sudden it's an hour or two later.
What's great is your primary care banker is available 24/7. And yes, it's a real human, which everyone appreciates with our busy clinical schedules. Check out Panacea Financial at coreiampodcast.com/Panacea. We'll link it in our show notes. Panacea Financial is a division of Primis, member FDIC. And with that, let's get back into the episode.
Malnutrition in hospitalized patient associated with high cost, longer stays, and increased mortality. The economic burden of malnutrition is huge. The human cost is 3 times higher in hospital deaths than in those without malnutrition, and people with it have twice longer hospital stays.
That's Dr. Maria Romanova, a hospitalist and the nutrition support team physician at the West Los Angeles VA Medical Center. And welcome to the Core IM Thigh Pearls podcast. I'm Dr. Shreya Trivedi.
And I'm Dr. Hina Mehta. I'm an internist at UT Southwestern.
I'm Dr. Margaret Lee, an internal medicine resident at BIDMC.
And today we are talking to VEDS. You're going to hear from four discussants ranging from dietitian to gastroenterologist to hospitals who think a lot about tube VEDS.
Yes, so let's get started with the pearls for this episode. Test yourself by pausing after each of the 5 questions.
Remember, the more you test yourself, the deeper your learning gains.
Pearl 1, approach to nutritional assessment in a patient. What are the indications for starting tube feeds?
Pearl 2, route of enteral access. What are the possible routes, and what are the 4 branch points you think through when deciding which enteral access is best for your patient?
Pearl 3, components of tube feeds. What are the differences in different types of tube feeds?
Pearl 4, tube feed complications. How do you think through your patient having diarrhea or having residuals after starting tube feeds? And is there anything you can do to improve aspiration risk?
Pearl 5, as we progress patients to discharge, how do we counsel our patients for success? And which medications interact with tube feeds?
You know, why don't we start with the definition of malnutrition? We hear it all the time, but to me, it's a somewhat nebulous concept.
We diagnose malnutrition based on patient's physical findings and the history of insufficient energy intake and the weight loss. We can detect malnutrition on physical exam by seeing loss of muscle mass or subcutaneous fat, or seeing the edema on the body not related to other causes, not congestive heart failure, not ascites of cirrhosis. It can also be diagnosed by diminished functional status. So any of the 6 things what I mentioned, if you take 2 of them and patient has 2 of them present, that's diagnostic of malnutrition.
Okay, so 2 from those 6 gets you to malnutrition, whether it's history of insufficient intake, or physical exam findings like loss of muscle mass or diminished functional status like diminished hand grip.
You know, guys, sometimes I see people using labs like albumin and prealbumin as objective markers to define malnutrition.
Albumin or prealbumin should not be used for diagnosis. Those are old criteria. I only use physical exam and history. And that's enough.
The teaching point here is that albumin or prealbumin are negative acute phase reactants that decrease with inflammation. So those acute phase reactants can definitely confound the patient's nutritional state.
Speaking of which, one thing that really surprised me is that prealbumin is actually transthyretin. The only reason it got called prealbumin is because it's the band on the gel electrophoresis in the position right before albumin, aka prealbumin.
Oh, I didn't know that prealbumin had nothing to do with albumin.
Same, right? It's fascinating how these things are named. Anyways, so I guess, say we're worried about a patient, they have loss of fat, muscle mass, low calorie intake. When do we think about starting tube feeds then?
Enteral nutrition is indicated in patients who are unable to meet their needs orally, even with oral nutrition supplements. And the timeline is 24 to 48 hours for critically ill patients, and after 1 week in non-critically ill patients, as long as the gastrointestinal tract is safe for use, enteral nutrition should be entertained and offered to these people.
And we also spoke to Cindy Huang, an inpatient dietitian in Houston, on how she thinks through initiating tube feeds.
If the gut works, we use it. That's kind of our phrase that, you know, we will describe to anybody. You know, if it works, we got to use it. And tube feeding is a way to continue to use the gut. The length of time we like to look at least from a dietitian standpoint, is, you know, 5 to 7 days of oral intake that's been less than 50% of their needs. Then looking at, are they improving or are they still going to continue to be struggling?
So where do these time cutoffs for initiating tube feeds actually come from? You know, the ones that say 2 days for ICU patients and 5 to 7 days in non-critically ill patients?
Yeah, these time cutoffs work as a general principle. What we do know is that starting early nutrition in critically ill patients can prevent things like stress ulcers and infectious complications from gut translocation.
Yeah, and some of our reviewer dietitians from Northwestern said that they actually recommend starting tube feeds a bit sooner in patients who are higher risk for malnutrition or have more needs, say in people who have large non-healing wounds or are post-op or after trauma.
We also talked to Dr. Brian Lee, a GI fellow at BIDMC, who had another important reason for starting tube feeds early.
Ideally, we want to feed through the gut. That's kind of what the gut is designed to do. And so you want to kind of maintain that mucosal integrity in the gut and to use the gut if you can. And so that's kind of another reason why we try to give enteral nutrition.
You know, when I tell my patients that all this time without any food in their gut causes the gut lining to break down, they're much more on board with protecting that from happening by starting tube feeds sooner.
Same. I actually started counseling patients on starting tube feeds early and accidentally started talking about villi and definitely got into the weeds.
Oh man, that sounds like a painful experience. I think we've all been there where we got too much into the weeds. Okay, so now that we have a clear sense of indications and benefits, I'm curious, are there times where we don't want to initiate tube feeds or want to delay it?
If the gut is not working, we really don't want to use it. We don't want to make things worse. So if there's any type of like intestinal obstructions, right, even if like a partial small bowel obstruction, we want to avoid tube feeding, ileus, you know, or even hypomobility or hypermobility, right? Something that there's just like a dysfunction in the gut process.
Okay, so avoid tube feeds if the gut is not working, say in ileus or obstruction, or if there are motility issues. Any other contraindications?
A contraindication would be if their, I mean, goals of care does not align with aggressive nutrition support, right?
Enteral nutrition, I don't recommend to initiate it on patients with very advanced dementia because there is no evidence that it prolongs life or it prevents aspiration. And those are important things for family to hear. And so I make sure that they hear it. And I do explain that if this is a situation where a patient has advanced dementia, they often do not suffer from hunger or thirst. And if we try to alleviate suffering, it's not giving them nutrition that will alleviate suffering. It's giving them peace and quiet, which is very hard to do in a hospital.
I'm glad she brought this up. You know, these end-of-life conversations can be pretty hard, and everyone has their own definition of suffering, especially when it comes to something like food. But I agree, something like NG tubes may lead to more suffering.
So let's recap. Malnutrition is currently diagnosed by history and physical exam, showing any two of the following: insufficient energy intake leading to weight, muscle mass, or fat loss, localized generalized fluid accumulation, and lastly, if it's contributing diminished functional status, like decreased grip strength.
Yes, and then in order to maintain that mucosal integrity of that gut, we want to generally think about starting tube feeds within 1 to 2 days in our ICU patients or within a week or so in our non-critically ill patients on the floors and whose trajectory we know is not improving, and even sooner in patients who are higher risk for malnutrition.
And lastly, the two big picture contraindications to tube feeds are if the gut's not working or if it's not in line with their goals of care.
All right, now that we have an idea of when to start tube feeds, what order do we put in the EMR for the route of the tube feeds, right? Do we do DAPOF, NG, OG, PEG, G-tube, GJ tube, J-tube?
Oh my goodness. It's so crazy that there are so many options.
I didn't know how many there were until we really had to list them here.
When I'm thinking about enteral access, the first branch point is, how long is the patient going to need enteral access? Is it something that's going to be more durable or something that's more of a temporary enteral access that's just kind of bridging the patient? The branch point is at about 4 weeks, typically is what we recommend. So if the patient is going to need enteral access for less than 4 weeks, usually we kind of plan for a temporary access. And then if it's going to be prolonged beyond that, then we're thinking about something a little bit more durable.
So we just heard about one branch point, temporary if you predict needing tube feeds for less than 4 weeks, or permanent / durable for more than 4 weeks. But there are three other important branch points to also consider. So ask yourself, one, is enteral access needed only for nutrition or also for medications? Two, is enteral access needed to decompress the stomach? And three, where should the tube terminate?
Yep. Why don't we start then with those patients who we think we only need tube feeds temporarily, you know, less than 4 weeks or so. What are the options for each of those three branch points you just mentioned, Margaret, with medications, decompression options, as well as how far the tube can go down?
The one that people see very commonly on the floors is the DAPOF tube. And this can be either placed from the nose or from the mouth down the esophagus and typically into the stomach, although it can be advanced post-pyloric in general under fluoroscopic guidance. At other institutions, they can sometimes do that at the bedside as well. The DAPOF tube is nice because it's soft, it's flexible, and it's, in comparison to some of the other tubes, it's not as uncomfortable. But really, its main use is to administer nutrition and medications as well. So you can't really use it for decompression. In contrast, sometimes, you know, people will call a nasogastric tube or like NG tube to use for decompression. Usually what they're referring to is a sump type of tube. So the most common type of sump tube is a Salem sump. And that's a tube, again, that can be placed from the nose or from the mouth. It's much more rigid. It's less comfortable. But not only does it allow you to administer medications and nutrition, but it also allows you to decompress the stomach.
And just to clarify, a DAPOF is technically a nasoenteric tube since it can go from the nose to the stomach as an NG or from the nose to the jejunum as an NJ. But it's just a bit smaller and more flexible, so it has a different name.
And so to recap, a DAPOF can be used for medications as well as feeds, but not for decompression. Compare that to an NG tube, which is more of that rigid Salem slump. That can be used for decompression as well as meds and tube feeds.
And technically, both DAPOFs and rigid NG tubes can be advanced post-pylorically.
And just so we're on the same page, the reason why one would advance it post-pyloric with a DAPOF is either, say, in gastroparesis where you don't want to irritate the stomach, or maybe the patient's not tolerating feeds, which we'll get to in Pearl 4, or they have pancreatitis. But honestly, there's mixed data if this really helps or not.
I would say that most of the data suggests that there's not a ton of difference between gastric feeds and jejunal feeding in pancreatitis. That said, you know, there are some attendings that prefer to do NJ tubes, for instance, for post-pancreatic feeding. I think it's a little bit of a stylistic thing.
So now let's explore the other side of the first branch point, long-term or more durable access, which can be used for 4 weeks or greater. For these cases, we typically think of the PEG tube and the G tube.
Wait, Margaret, are you saying the PEG tube and the G tube aren't the same thing?
Yeah, the difference mainly lies in knowing how PEG and G tubes are placed. And believe it or not, knowing how it's inserted helps you know who to consult, either GI or interventional radiology / surgery.
A PEG tube, it stands for percutaneous endoscopic gastrostomy tube. And as kind of the name implies, it's a tube that goes from the skin and it's placed with endoscopic assistance. And so what happens when a PEG tube is placed is we do an upper endoscopy and get into the stomach. And then from the skin, we kind of poke through a needle and put in essentially like a string. And that is then pulled out through the mouth, and you attach that to a long tube. And then you pull the string from the skin side, and that tube then gets dragged down into the esophagus and gets pulled up against the wall of the stomach. And there's like a little bumper there that kind of keeps the tube in place so you don't just like pull it out through the skin.
When we're talking about PEG tubes, that PEG tube is pulled down endoscopically down the esophagus and percutaneously inserted into the stomach.
So I imagine if there's an esophageal tumor obstruction, you can't get the PEG tube down.
Yep. For those instances where we can't mechanically get from the esophagus down to the stomach, we would opt for a G tube rather than a PEG tube.
In contrast, a G tube, which is placed by IR, is done a little bit differently. They introduce a needle from the skin into the stomach. And eventually what happens is they kind of anchor the stomach to the wall of the abdomen. They can sometimes use these kind of anchoring buttons. And then when they have a good spot, they place a tube in.
So it sounds like they're sewing a button from the outside.
Yeah, it does. I just imagine IR doing these G2s with their fancy tools. But really, it's like sewing. Okay, so it sounds like both PEG and G-tubes can be used for medications, nutrition, as well as decompression. All a win. Check, check, check.
Okay, so that's PEG tubes versus G-tubes. But then how do you think about other long-term options, even lower in the GI tract, like GJ tubes and J-tubes?
A GJ tube is kind of similar to a G-tube, except it has a longer extension that goes into the small bowel, again, typically placed by IR. And in that case, there'll be three ports on it. There'll be one for the balloon, one for the stomach, and then one for the jejunum. And then finally, the J-tube is typically placed by surgery, where they will thread a tube from the skin and then surgically place it into the small bowel and kind of tack it in place.
He loves saying that IR surgery places it, but I bet it's all hospital dependent who takes ownership of what.
Right. I bet he spends a lot of time clarifying that. But I think I'm still wondering, you know, when are we reaching for that GJ or J tube and really want to make sure we are having access that down in the GI tract?
So that's usually when you're thinking about a GJ is when there's something wrong at the pylorus, at the level of the pylorus, or some type of gastric outlet obstruction, most often malignant. Typically what's often done if there's a problem at the level of the pylorus, for instance, like a gastric outlet obstruction, is that you can take the gastric port and just put it to gravity. So you're decompressing whatever oral secretions and so forth. And so they're not vomiting. And then the J tube is then theoretically beyond the level of obstruction. And you're administering, you know, nutrition and medications and so forth into the J tube.
Okay, that makes sense to use GJ tubes for severe gastroparesis. You can feed through the J, aka the jejunum, since the stomach motility is compromised. And in gastroparesis, we wouldn't want to feed through the G, aka the gastric part.
And that leaves the G part of the GJ tube for decompression, if needed.
So let me summarize. When we're thinking about tube feeds, we have to think about, is this artificial nutrition, enteral nutrition, going to be needed for less than 4 weeks or so? If it is going to be needed for less than 4 weeks, then we can reach for a DOPOFS, especially if you only need it for nutrition and medications and don't necessarily need it for decompression. You can also advance DOPOFS, pass the stomach. If you do need decompression short term, then you want to reach for that typical rigid Salem slump NG or NJ tube.
If you think tube feeds are going to be needed for more than 4 weeks, you can ask GI to endoscopically place a PEG, which gives you 1 to 2 ports for medications and tube feeds. but you have to make sure that GI can get from the mouth to the stomach without issues. Alternatively, IR or surgery can do a G-tube. If there is a lesion, gastroparesis, or obstruction lower down the post-pylorus, then a GGA tube or a J-tube may make more sense.
Just a quick word from our sponsor, Factor. Spring is here, and I want us to all imagine spring where mealtime stress is a thing of the past, where gourmet, nutritious meals await you, no prep or cleanup required. And this is where Factor steps in, transforming your mealtime into a stress-free experience. With Factor, you get to enjoy chef-prepared, dietitian-approved meals that are ready in just 2 minutes. I use it for my family weekly, and I can attest to how tasty the meals are, even for my three-year-old. You get a weekly menu of 35 different options, plus you can indulge in 60 add-ons from breakfast, snacks to beverages. And on top of that, this April, you can celebrate Earth Day with Factor all month long. You can choose their Earth Month Eats for meals with the lowest carbon footprint. So are you ready to eat stress-free? Head over to factormeals.com/coreim50. Use the code coreim50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off the next box. Again, use the code coreim50 at factormeals.com/coreim50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while the subscription is active. Now with that, let's get back to the episode. You know, guys, out of everything, I think the biggest black box for me is the actual tube feeds itself. The different types of tube feed formulas really feel like a foreign language to me. And honestly, I'm just hoping it's an hour in the day where nutrition is around to help me, because my gosh, if it's like after 4 p.m. or the weekend, then I feel like I'm just choosing arbitrarily, yeah, this one for my patient.
Girl, I got you, Shreya. Big picture, whatever we choose, it's better to start on the lower side, ideally starting nutritional support at 50% of the patient's estimated needs.
There is a caveat, though. For patients on pressors or those at risk for refeeding syndrome, we want to start tube feeds much less than 50% of their needs and increase the rate much more slowly. I find it's best to work with the nutritionist during these situations.
So once we do those calculations, we have our numbers, then we will look at kind of what medical picture, right? Do they have like a fluid restriction where then we would have to pick formulas that are more calorie dense? Can they be on a standard formula? Do they need a specialized formula?
All right. So then it sounds like we need to see if the patient's going to tolerate a quote unquote standard formula. But guys, what even is a standard formula?
So a standard formula specifically contains whole intact proteins, which means the patient's digestive system needs to do the work and break down those amino acid chains. These formulas can be oral or given via a tube. Some examples are Nutrin and Isosource.
But sometimes I see a number after the standard formulas, like Nutrin 1.0 or Isosource 1.2. So is 1.2 just an updated version of 1.0?
A standard formula would have like 1 to 1.2 calories per milliliter. There's a little bit more dense would be 1.5. You see that number a lot in the formulas on the market, 1.5.
Oh my goodness. It is so good to know that the number behind the name of the formula actually means how many calories are in a milliliter of the formula. So I guess to put into context, I like to close a loop. Let's do some quick math. If a patient is getting 1 liter of Nutrin 1.0, a liter is 1,000 milliliters. And if there's one calorie in each milliliter, then we know our patient's getting 1,000 calories.
And did you know that about 70 to 85% of tube feeds is actually just water? So if a patient is fluid sensitive, then knowing if the tube feed is 1.0 versus 1.5 can make a big difference.
That makes sense, right? Like if a patient needs fluid restriction, then we would want to choose a more calorie-dense tube feed for the same amount of fluid, right? So like a formula like Nutrin 1.5, if there's 1.5 calories per milliliter, then I can get away with just getting like 660 mLs of Nutrin 1.5 to get 1,000 calories.
So it's always better to choose a denser formula then, right?
Well, everything has its pros and cons. You see, denser formulas have higher osmolality. So hypertonic formulas like Isosource 1.5 can increase the risk for osmotically induced diarrhea when compared to its less calorically dense counterparts.
That is no fun, but good to be aware of. Okay, so what are the other different types of formulas that we might see out there?
The name kind of give you a little bit of an idea of the patient type it's tailored towards. Most commonly, institutions will have like a low carbohydrate formula because that's often needed, right, by patients, Glucerna, and then Diabetisource. There are also specialized formulas for patients that need low electrolytes and lower protein for renal disease. There's another option for renal disease patients, low electrolytes, but high protein for those that are on dialysis, right? Because for dialysis, you lose protein through that process, and your protein needs are actually higher now that you are getting dialysis and your kidneys aren't worried about the high protein, right? You actually need more.
One example of a low electrolyte, low protein formula in patients with CKD is Suplena. And then for patients on dialysis where you want to reach for low electrolyte but high protein formula, you might choose Nepro.
That's really helpful. You know, I'm just wondering about my patients who might not be able to digest a typical standard formula and break down those whole proteins that you were talking about, Margaret. I'm thinking about the patients who might have an abnormal digestive tract.
If you have some abnormal digestion, either with the pancreas, if the patient has had a Whipple, then you go for like semi-elemental.
That is Dr. Amelie Therrien, a GI attending at BIDMC with an interest in clinical GI nutrition. She is referring to a semi-elemental formula, which consists of partially predigested, but not fully predigested peptides, polymers, and medium-chain triglycerides.
An example of a common semi-elemental formula is Peptamen AF, which I remember all the time because my student used to call it Peptamen as F.
Oh my gosh, it's hilarious. Yikes.
But it's not what you think it means. AF actually just means advanced formula.
Oh, okay. All right, guys, I guess now that I know what semi-elemental is, I'm guessing if a patient needs even more assistance with digestion, we'll probably move from semi-elemental to just elemental formula, which I imagine is just the simplest peptides and sugars.
Yep, elemental formulas require minimal digestive tract effort.
If you have someone that has a very severe enteropathy, that has celiac disease, autoimmune enteropathy, then you try the elemental formula, because what you have on top of your villi in your intestine are brush border enzymes. You need the brush border enzymes at the tip of your villi to continue the digestion, to go from disaccharide to like regular like glucose, and to get from little chains of peptides to amino acids. So if you have a severe enteropathy, you're not having those enzymes, and then you need to have an elemental formula.
Oh man, when those brush border enzymes are MIA, you have to go for an elemental formula.
Unfortunately, Vivanex is the only elemental formula we usually have, and that's super expensive.
So I guess if I were to summarize what I'm taking away about choosing tube feeds, it seems like the first thing to think about is our patient's gut, right? To say, okay, is this person going to tolerate a standard formula of whole proteins that their gut needs to digest? Or does this person have some enteropathy or abnormality with their pancreas that's not producing the enzymes it needs, and they might benefit more from a semi-elemental or an elemental formula?
Then we can pay attention to the number after the name of a tube feed, which stands for how many calories per milliliter is in that formula. For patients who may be fluid sensitive, we reach for more calorie-dense formulas like 1.5 instead of 1.0.
All right, so after we start tube feeds, I do a little prayer that I don't get a page, that there's some complication about the tube feed, because honestly, I'm like, oh, not my area of expertise.
Oh yeah, same. I'm always nervous I'm going to get a page that's like, your patient is hypoxic. And I think, crap, are they aspirating? Or, oh, your patient's having diarrhea, to calls about residuals.
Yeah, so much good ground to cover. Let's start with diving into aspiration. And I think we all know the typical teaching that we get about preventing aspiration.
It's a risk when you start tube feeding. So any patient that is gastrically fed should be at an angle of minimum of 30 degrees. Some places might say like 45, will depend on policy, I'm sure. And if it's on cyclic feeding or gravity feeding, having patients sit up for at least 30 to 45 minutes after you're done, right? Kind of letting it go past your gut, like not sitting in the gut or in the stomach, to prevent any risk of aspiration.
But is sitting up 30 to 45 degrees for 30 to 45 minutes after eating enough?
we know we're aware of aspiration risk. The real problem is there is no evidence that anything we do helps, like positioning the patient. We do it, but there is no good evidence underneath it. In reality, there is a thought that aspiration is actually caused by aspirating oral secretion and not necessarily the tube feeds, which is even harder to prevent.
Oh, God. I feel like the next thing you're going to tell me is that post-pyloric tube feeds don't actually help aspiration either.
One of the questions that comes up often is whether feeding in the stomach versus the small bowel has an increased risk of aspiration and aspiration pneumonia. And there's not a huge amount of data, but I would say that most of the data suggests that there's not really any significant benefit to post-pyloric feeding with regards to reducing aspiration pneumonia as compared to gastric feeding. The thought being that typically aspiration pneumonia in these circumstances is more related to oral secretions and like oral pharyngeal aspiration, oral pharyngeal dysphagia, or, you know, difficulty with oral secretions rather than with like frank vomiting from the stomach.
But with that being said, I guess it is empowering to know where the real risk of aspiration really comes from, the oral secretions, and focus on ways to stay on top of that if possible.
And I feel like this should be said explicitly. Even though there hasn't been a definite proven benefit yet, I'm still going to advocate raising the head of bed and staying upright after feed, because that's the best practice we have. And honestly, it at least helps me sleep at night.
Yeah. And at least it's free.
Oh, yeah, you're right. It is free to raise the head above the bed. Okay, why don't we move on to the next complication we might get paged about? Say you get a page that the patient is having diarrhea after tube feed starting.
Most common, I think, just intolerance, whether that's diarrhea or some people have some nausea or like discomfort, cramping, that type of, you know, reaction. It can be hard to discern whether it's the tube feed or whether it's just introducing something into their gut when they haven't had anything in their gut for a little bit, right? A lot of times, the reason why we have them have a tube is because they haven't been eating. So even in that amount of time, your gut starts atrophying if you're not giving it anything, right? So it does take a little bit of time for your guts to like recover and rebuild and have enough to do its job.
And so one big misconception that we've all had is attributing the diarrhea to the formula and unfortunately stopping the tube feeds. But that's probably not what's best for the gut.
It was caused by the introduction of formula, yes. But it's probably not just the formula, right? Because for patients that, you know, have had not much in their gut for a while, the gut starts atrophying. It's going to take time for it to respond.
Most of the time, the answer is to not stop the tube feeds, especially if the tube feeds are started at a low rate, like 10 to 20 cc's an hour. Just give the gut a little bit more time to acclimate.
Whenever we encounter this, we always need to rule out other reasons for diarrhea, for example, C. diff colitis. It's not that common that enteric feeds cause diarrhea, but sometimes we need to change one formulation to another, a standard tube feeds to, let's say, semi-elemental or elemental formula.
Even look at that med list and discontinue bowel regimens they're on.
You can also try a bulking agent like Benefiber or psyllium husk. But sure, if they continue to have a lot of intolerance, such as nausea, cramping, or diarrhea, try switching the formula.
Okay, and then last but not least, residuals. I feel like when I was in residency, which is eons ago, we monitored residuals, which seems like an outdated practice now.
What gastric residual volume is, when nurse uses a syringe to remove gastric content, she measures the volume, and in most cases, she returns them into the stomach. It has been studied excessively, and it turned out that routine measurement of gastric residual volumes poorly correlates with aspiration, pneumonias, or even with gastric emptying, or even with nausea and vomiting. But what it correlates with is with suboptimal nutrition delivery. So it's not recommended anymore to do it routinely.
What should I do when a nurse still calls about gastric residual volumes? This still happens from time to time.
It's only if GRV is over 500, we do recommend to hold it for an hour and then resume tube feeds and maybe check it a little later. Basically, the common practice now is not to measure it, but to monitor for patient symptoms. If you see that gastric residual volume is consistently elevated, or if patient shows other signs of feeding intolerance, you can consider giving them a prokinetic agent, metoclopramide 5 to 10 milligram 4 times a day, or erythromycin 4 times a day. They can be used individually or in combination.
So it sounds like routine measuring of gastric residual volume is outdated, and the focus is more on symptom monitoring. If it does get checked and it's over 500 or so, we can hold it for an hour and then resume tube feeds. And as a last resort, start a prokinetic agent if needed.
Yep. And then why don't we summarize our takeaways from the other common complications with tube feeds we've covered? I think the big teaching point with aspiration is that aspiration is actually caused by oral secretions rather than the tube feeds itself. And despite us doing this all the time, evidence for patient positioning to prevent aspiration has yet to show much of a benefit.
With diarrhea in tube-fed patients, the diarrhea is usually not from the tube feeds itself, but actually from the gut atrophy, since these patients may not have eaten much for a long time. Next time I get this call about diarrhea, I'll try to give the gut some more time and put the tube feeds at a slower rate. Then think of all the other things that can be causing diarrhea. And lastly, if it's not getting any better, talk to the dietitian about adding a bulking agent or possibly changing up the formula.
Now let's round out things with what kind of tube feed schedule we're progressing patients to, especially as they get to discharge, and what counseling and nuances we should give around medications.
Most of the patients will start on continuous tube feeding in general, especially in the inpatient setting. We have that freedom to start them there, to also get them acclimated, right, and to kind of increase tolerance for it. If they're going home with tube feeds, most people will transition to bolus or gravity feeds. Technically, bolus feeding in like the in our dietetic world is really where you're using a syringe and pushing through the formula in like a bolus, like a true bolus, if that makes sense. And then gravity drip is technically a bolus too. So it does take longer than a bolus, but it's gravity dripping. It's intermittent feeding. It's mimicking meals similar to what a bolus would be. So they're a little bit different, but they're kind of similar in terms of timing. And they don't have to be attached to the pump, right, continuously for 24 hours a day. And so most people will switch over to that. But of course, we also have to test their tolerance with that, especially transitioning from the continuous feeding to a gravity or bolus feeding.
So we are progressing patients from continuous 24-hour tube feeds to cycle feeds.
And so cycle feeds is a scheduled regimen that's continuous, but usually less than 24 hours. And oftentimes we see it done at nighttime.
And then from there, we progress patients either to gravity or bolus feeds.
I've definitely made that mistake of saying someone is ready to go home, and the RN looks at me on case management rounds and reminds me, they're still on continuous tube feeds.
Oh, yes. We've all been there, Margaret. So it sounds like gravity and bolus feed is the way to go, especially if someone's planning on going home or we just want to give them more freedom in the daytime to move around and also be done with cycled feeds too. But are there any contraindications to bolus or gravity and situations where we should stick to continuous tube feeds or cycled feeds at nighttime?
Of course, like if you can't tolerate having a larger volume of formula in one sitting, then you will have to do it more like a continuous or cyclic feeding, kind of spreading out the volume you're getting over a course of time, right? So someone maybe with delayed gastric emptying, right? Probably not a great idea to bolus or gravity feed, or if they've had any type of changes anatomically to their gut, that might be something to consider.
And maybe the biggest oversight that precludes patients from getting bolus feeds is if their tube does not terminate in the stomach. You see, our stomach is a nice reservoir to support a bolus of tube feeds.
Yeah, that makes sense. We can't bolus into the jejunum, right? Jejunum isn't really a reservoir at all. It doesn't expand like the stomach.
So if someone has a GJ or J tube, you'd likely want to progress them to cycled or nocturnal feeds.
And then what other things should we be educating our patients on about tube feeds? Like, how do we set up our patients for success when they go home?
I think one thing that sometimes patients forget to do is to flush the tube after they feed. So particularly patients that are on bolus or cycled, And so there are times where patients come in, they have an endoscopically placed NJ tube, everything's great, they're discharged home, and then it clogs the next day because they don't flush it, and they come back and we scope them again. And so that's one of the key things, is to like make sure they flush their tube when they're done with their feed, and to flush it like immediately, not to like, oh, my cycle finished a while ago, I'm going to like go around and do some other stuff, and then I'm going to flush it later, because then it's like too late already.
Oh, I really appreciate that. I didn't know how time-sensitive flushing was.
Another good rule of thumb with free water flushes is to increase the flushes if it's a more concentrated formula.
Oh, that makes sense. I remember Hina telling us that most of the tube feeds is 70 to 85% water, and probably less, right, on the lower side if it's more concentrated. So that's good to know. The other thing I didn't really appreciate until we talked to our discussants is the impact of everyday medications on tube feeds. For example, something that most patients reflexively are on when they're admitted, polyethylene glycol.
Myrelax is kind of like an osmolar solution that will make like the water or the liquid with it not being absorbed. So if you're giving the Myrelax with tube feed, then your tube feeds will not be fully absorbed. And the same goes for cholestyramine.
And now that Dr. Therian has said that, it makes a lot of sense. Something like polyethylene glycol would impact the absorption of tube feeds.
Yeah, that's good to know. Is there any other counseling we should give our patients regarding their medication timings and their tube feeds?
There are only four medications where enteric feeding has been shown to affect absorption. And for those four medications, you need to hold tube feeds for a couple of hours before and a couple of hours after. Those four medications are phenytoin, carbamazepine, warfarin, and fluoroquinolone antibiotics. So at least for antibiotics, we can switch them to IV route if it's reasonable.
One way to keep this all straight is maybe a mnemonic about the three A's. You know, one is A for antiepileptics, phenytoin, carbamazepine, A for anticoagulation with warfarin, and A for antibiotics for fluoroquinolone. Rule of thumb is we want to hold tube feeds, usually sounds like an hour, some resources 30 minutes or so before and after giving meds.
I did a lot of reading about it, and there is a small caveat for the antiepileptics in newer guidelines and papers from 2021 saying that we really don't have to hold tube feeds from antiepileptics, but there are still a lot of mixed practices and the interaction is real.
Okay, good to know. The other thing to keep in mind about medications is to ask yourself, is that medicine extended release? I'll often get a page from pharmacy after ordering diltiazem extended release or even Paxlovid that it can't be crushed.
Thankfully, some of these medications like diltiazem, you can actually switch to its immediate release form.
There's also alternatives, right? You can always do like a liquid formulation, but then it's being considerate of how the liquid formulation is made. Like, does it contain sorbitol, which is something that can increase the risk of diarrhea? And you're thinking, oh gosh, like, is it the tube feeds? Oh no, maybe it's the sorbitol. So something to check as well. And dietitians should be aware of that. You know, they can look through their medications.
One common example of a liquid medication that has sorbitol is actually liquid Tylenol.
Oh, something we use all the time. Good to remember. All right, we've covered a ton of good ground on prepping patients for discharge and counseling. It sounds like, summarizing, ideally we want to transition patients to bolus or gravity feeds, but especially if they have like a J tube or a GJ tube where you're feeding into a smaller space, you can't really bolus into the small bowel.
I also learned to counsel patients to flush right away after feeds to prevent ER visits for clogging.
And lastly, we need to advise to hold tube feeds for at least an hour or so before and after giving the three A's, the anticoagulant warfarin, the antibiotic class fluoroquinolones, and oftentimes antiepileptics like phenytoin and carbamazepine.
And that is a wrap for today. If you want to learn more about tube feeds, check out our YouTube channel where we're linked to some of the original interviews.
If you found this episode helpful, please share it with your team and colleagues and give us a rating on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast app you use. It really does help people find us.
Thank you to Dr. Murata Sakunsangparpa for the accompanying graphic, to Doc Shabathia for the audio editing. Thank you to our reviewers, Shaina Schapp, Danielle Holm, as well as Dr. Ali Tepper and Dr. Chetan Ramaprasad. Opinions expressed are our own and do not represent the opinions of any affiliated institutions.
The ones that say two. Oh my God. Hold on.
You're there.
I think I just have all the saliva in my mouth.
So inconvenient.
Please share it with your team and colleagues and give it a rating on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast app you use. It really does help us find people. Or wait.
So who are you looking for? Missing position.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.